Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times bestselling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida, Craig's most recent column on the FloridaPhoenix.com. You can read that every week. This week, about seagrass, and it ties back to a number of topics we've dealt with recently: Indian River Lagoon, manatee deaths, Piney Point, phosphorus, gyp stack overflowing, red tide. Yeah. This brings a lot of topics together that are central to the podcast recently.
What got me started was I kept seeing these stories about how many tons of sea life were being collected here in Pinellas County as a result of the red tide. Mm-hmm. And so I called up the person who was in charge of that, the County Public Works Director, Kelly Hammer Levy, and said, I keep seeing these tonnages, but what kind of fish are being collected? Oh, well, we have these massive Goliath grouper. You've got sea robins. We talked about some of that stuff. And then she said, oh, and seagrass. And I said, wait, what, seagrass? She said, oh, yeah, we're bringing in tons of seagrass. Mm. It looks like it's fine, except it's dead. And that sort of sent me on this thing talking about how, the pollution of our waterways is fueling these algae blooms. And while we're focused on the deaths of the, the fish, what we're really killing are that's bad is the seagrass, because the seagrass is sort of the foundation of our marine life out there. And it's what the manatees eat. And so you lose the seagrass, you lose everything.
Yeah. Manatees are on license plates, and Florida panthers on the license plate, and sport fishermen in the fish. But when you go to the root of these problems, you have to drill down further. You drill down to seagrass, and ultimately, here's another shocker. It comes up in every episode. You drill down, Craig, to water.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it was interesting. After I wrote the column and turned it in, I was watching the State Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission meeting that took place in Bonita Springs, where they talked about the manatee die-offs. And the experts were saying, well, the bottom line here is we don't have enough seagrass to feed the manatees. And the key to that, and the commissioners are saying, what's one thing we can do? They said, well, improve water quality. If we had better water quality, we'd have more seagrass. We had more seagrass, it wouldn't be killing the manatees. Mm-hmm. And several people in the public got up to talk. People who I know are not necessarily conservationists. They would love to hunt panthers if they got the chance and things like that. But they were saying, we agree with you. We want to save the seagrass. You lose seagrass, we don't have ducks to go hunt. Mm-hmm. And, you lose seagrass, we don't have fish to catch. And they get it too.
Yeah. Okay. So someone's listening to this podcast, and I'm going to ask Craig Pittman, the state's leading environmental reporter for 20. Well, why don't we just clean up the water? What the hell? Well, if everyone knows the solution, why don't we do it?
Because we lack the political will, because the people who are putting out that pollution don't really want to pay for what it would take to clean it up. Okay. So sewer plants, we've got lots and lots of developers building communities using septic tanks, which
is unimaginable in 2021.
Yeah. We're spending taxpayer dollars to replace septic tanks. And at the same time, we're permitting new development with septic tanks near our waterways.
Because septic tanks leak to help people out. Septic tanks leak, you get raw sewage going into the groundwater.
Agricultural operations that put lots of fertilizer out, and also suburban homeowners putting out lots of fertilizer. Mm-hmm. Some cities and other local governments have tried to impose summertime bans on the sale of fertilizer as a way to try and clean up their waterways. Well, that's a good first step. And man, the fertilizer companies have fought them tooth and nail trying to stop that. So, those are all things that
Agriculture, mining, phosphate mining. We talked about that in the episode last week about the springs. Development, mining, agriculture. Right.
These are all the big money factors in our politics. So, for instance, Governor DeSantis swore he would do something about all the toxic algae blooms, got into office, appointed some blue ribbon scientists appointed a blue ribbon panel of scientists, legit top scientists, to give him recommendations on how to fix it. They prepared a report saying, here's what you need to do. Here are the steps. And the legislature passed a bill that completely ignored all of that. Yeah. And it was all, pardon the pun, watered down to the point where, they called it the Clean Waterways Act, but it was more like the Window Dressing Act.
Yeah.
And, that's kind of what happens. You get scientists who say, here are the things you need to do. And the legislature says, I can't do that. Those are the people who give me my big campaign contributions.
Yeah. It's... I don't know if you would say it's an easy solution, but not a simple solution, or clean up the water. But it's the people who are polluting the water who have all the political power in the state, agriculture, mining, and development. That's why you have a solution that's as clear as the nose in front of your face that we continue to sit here and wrestle with and do nothing about as seagrass dies off, manatees die off, fish get killed, blue-green algae, red tide, the water table becomes a sewer.
The crazy thing is, that has an economic impact too. I mean, that hurts the tourism industry, hurts the fishing industry. You know, how can you favor one industry over another when that's the result? And so, but that's where we're at right now.
That is where we're at right now. And most people, many people, anyway, Craig and I recording this, it's lunchtime. And lunch for a lot of people means a sandwich. And how about a Cuban sandwich? Now, Craig, before we were recording this episode, told me something I had no idea about. And we'll get into this in the interview here.
This is going to be the most controversial issue we ever talked
about. I had no idea
about.
There was a big controversy in Florida about Cuban sandwiches, of all things.
Yes, a big interstate rivalry between Miami and Tampa, and where Tampa actually adopted the Cuban sandwich as their official sandwich. They are officially the birthplace of the Cuban sandwich, and people in Miami threw a fit. And I mean, all but, you know, took out big loaves of bread and started fighting each other like Star Wars lightsabers. I mean, it was.
Well, we'll try and get to the bottom of this controversy. What makes a Cuban sandwich? Where did it come from? Andrew Hughes is our guest. He has previously written the book From Saloons to Steakhouses, A History of Tampa. And in 2022 is going to be releasing The Cuban Sandwich, A History in Layers.
Andy, how did you first get interested in this extremely controversial topic of Cuban sandwiches?
I became interested in Tampa's history. It was like 20 years ago, plus more than 20 years ago. And really, as a graduate student, I was kind of looking at the city's history. And, you know, it seemed like a lot of this stuff had been done very thoroughly. Cigar workers, for example, things like that. But then the other stuff that really had outlasted the cigar industry was, it had a lot less scrutiny, I guess you could say, by historians. So I just thought here was a kind of an oblique way at getting at history. And so like I've kind of demonstrated that a little bit in the Saloons to Steakhouses book that came out last year, The History of Tampa. I inadvertently wrote too many books. And so we had to
cut
one book out of that. So what we were left with was the book with the places without the food, if that makes any sense. But in the course of doing that, I had a very good exercise of doing a lot of research about the Cuban sandwich. And anyway, found a lot more than I kind of expected to, I guess. And just spending so long with the subject, it kind of inadvertently was thrust on me. It wasn't something that I sort of sought out. Just to go back a little bit, years ago in the 2000s, probably 2004, so 2005, I wrote a piece for Cigar City magazine, which is a local magazine, about the Cuban sandwich. And basically that maybe instead of calling, you know, Tampa Cigar City, you know, we should be calling it Cuban Sandwich City, because there's far more Cuban sandwiches left than cigars, really. And and then there was the whole controversy of, you know, is it Miami, is it Tampa, which is really a false question. And I can get into that later. But I heard a lot of people in Tampa grousing that, you know, oh, it had been on here long before, you know, anyone in Miami was talking about it. So it just got me to thinking about it. And then also when I tasted the Cuban sandwich the first time, I was kind of unimpressed, you know, it's sort of like, okay, this is what all the fuss is about, really? And then I started to wonder what, you know, when I started to read about all the work people would put into it back in the days before loaves of lunch meat and, you know, electric slicers and all this stuff, that maybe this is something that was really cool that had largely been lost, I think, to convenience, et cetera. So I kind of considered looking back at it. Now I kind of look at the sandwich as kind of the canary in the coal mine in a way. It's like one of the most susceptible things of like Latin food culture to be really adulterated and to become a shadow of its former self. And there's a lot of different reasons why it sort of raced to the bottom. I mean, that's what a lot of things do in American culture when they become adopted. So it wasn't unique in that regard, but it had a lot of other pressures on it as well that I was able to kind of suss out in the source of the course of doing all this research.
So for our listeners who are not familiar with the Cuban sandwich, what makes up a Cuban sandwich, and what's its origin story?
So yeah, the Cuban sandwich is really popular. It was invented in Cuba. It became the Cuban sandwich when it migrated to the United States. In Cuba, it was just a mixed sandwich or a mixed dough. A lot of people just knew it as the sandwich. And the thing is it was a mixed sandwich. So as it implies, it was an amorphous creation. Now, the two most common forms of meat that you'd probably find in most Cuban emporium, say in the late 1800s and early 1900s, because that's how far back this goes. This Cuban sandwich goes back to Cuban independence or before. But the most common types you would find is ham and roast pork. And in Cuba, that means mojo roast pork, which is marinated with, you know, vinegar. Typically, there's lots of citrus like sour orange and or lime, garlic, certainly some dry oregano in there. And then there could be some other things as well. But that's the main profile of the pork. So you put those on together and see when sandwiches were becoming super, super popular in, say, the 1880s, 1890s, around the turn of the 20th century, people didn't really mix ingredients that much together. I mean, it was kind of unusual to even see a meat and cheese sandwich, you know, never mind two kinds of meat. Now, the club sandwich was really a pioneer in this regard. So in the 1890s, the club sandwich came along, which is a layered thing, which has multiple meats in it, et cetera, and became sort of more elaborate over time. So the Cuban sandwich came right on the heels of this. And what's interesting is the origin is impossible to pin down exactly. You know, you can identify the universe in which it was created, but that universe was all these different enclaves in Cuba and beyond were all linked by steamships. So in theory, the first guy who made a sandwich, say in Havana or New York City, could have got on a ship, or one of his customers could have got on a ship and later that day been someplace else and then decided they were making a sandwich there. I mean, it was the kind of thing that I think would have disseminated very quickly. And, you know, Cuban food was really evolving at the time, you know, the 1800s. And not just that, but becoming a source of Cuban identity, separate from Spain. So a lot of Cuba's, you know, culinary identity had been passed down to it from Spain. So in the mid-1800s, there was a real big effort among intellectuals to claim certain foods as being Cuban or more criollo than Spanish. And then you've got the interface of the United States where, you know, just by virtue of economics, you know, Cuba is beginning to sort of, just like the people said, politicians had said almost a century before, that just by virtue of kind of gravity, that Cuba would eventually drop into the United States lap. You know, and that's about this time that this was happening, because Spain was faltering economically. Cuba was, you know, really vying for independence, and the U.S. didn't want to see some other colonial power get in there. Basically, then you have this very complicated and ultimately doomed romance between the U.S. and Cuba, where they're going to have this glorious future together that didn't quite work out, or didn't work for everybody, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Did the pigs from which the ham or pork was made come from Spain?
Right. Yeah. So yeah, what's interesting is there's an anthropologist, a really renowned anthropologist in Cuba, Fernando Ortiz. He's sort of the godfather of kind of Cuban identity and a lot of the theoretical stuff. And he identified a dish, a stew called ajiaco, also known as sancocho elsewhere in the Caribbean. But it's this dish that basically was a metaphor for Cuba, for colonial Cuba. So it's got Spanish beef or pork in it. It's got the chilies that the Indians often ate. And then it has a lot of starch, like tuber vegetables associated with slave food.
Yeah.
So basically with those three, you know, groups, you've got this this stew. And the idea about ajiaco that is never really done. It's the kind of thing that used to simmer into banana leaves in a hole, just, you know, and heated by the sun, you know, very hot in Cuba.
Yeah.
And the idea that you could just keep adding ingredients to the stew. And so like this stew, Cuba's never really finished. It's not it's a constantly evolving thing. And unlike the melting pot of the United States, where ingredients just kind of dissolve into it, they retain some of their shape and, you know, some of their identity and texture, but they also seep up the flavors around them.
flavors influence each other. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, it's a process he calls transculturation, you know, just, but it's culture basically, you know, being transmitted by osmosis almost by this mix, you know, ingredients mixing. So my argument really is that if you want to understand modern Cuba, you have to look at the Cuban sandwich. It's far more complex and it's far more modern. It's portable. It's much more expensive. It depends on lots of imported ingredients and a lot of industrial processing. It's a much more complicated animal, right? And I think a lot like Cuba, it's very difficult to find a consensus about exactly what a Cuban sandwich is. You know, there's a lot of debate about this, especially, you know, among exiles who can actually afford to eat such a thing.
And between devotees of the Miami style versus the Tampa style.
Right. And it's just, you know, it's just differences in time and space. So it's just like if you had members of a family who immigrated to the U.S. from Cuba in 1900, the habits and things they would have picked up would have been much different than someone coming in 1960, for example. You can look at variations in the way bread is made, different ingredients put on. And, you know, what's interesting is for a long time, Tampa's kind of signature sandwich was the usual pork and ham, and then you've got your pickles and Swiss cheese on Cuban bread. You know, the sandwich in Tampa also had turkey and salami.
Right.
We've since lost the turkey. But what's interesting is right around World War II is when the turkey probably peaked and it started to kind of get phased out after that. But what's interesting is I found a reference in Cuba to a sandwich that was the exact same thing. You know, they didn't call it a Cuban sandwich. They called it Sortito de Flauta. And this is in 1950, but it's a fluted assortment or an assortment of meats on fluted Cuban bread. So Cuban bread is that long fluted is the term for the, you know, stretching the loaf like that. So there's a lot of variations. And like, I could see a lot of people in Cuba trying to outdo each other. I put a slice of sopressata on mine. I put a slice of, you know, this and that on mine. Or the other thing being that the original mixed sandwich could very well have just come about from a customer saying, give me both kinds of meats or give me all three or whatever you have.
Someone being hungry and indecisive.
Right. Or it just could be, give me it all, you know? Yeah. And so, you know, I think a lot of it depended on what the vendor actually had on hand that what would have made it into their sandwich, you know? So for a lot of people on the street, two meats would have been plenty to have to keep track of. Yeah. But if you get into a fancier place that's got more, that was part of, you know, the process of trying to imagine all this stuff is just looking at ads in old Cuban newspapers. And, you know, they're all boasting of refrigerated imported ingredients, you know, and that there's a lonchero or a lunch man, you know, who is responsible for slicing up meats. He's at the German center, not at a Cuban style restaurant, but at the German center would have had lots and lots of imported cold cuts. So it's interesting because I think a lot of people don't think of turkey, for example, as like a Cuban ingredient. But then you've also got the Eleanor Roos sandwich, which turkey is the meat on the Eleanor Roos, which for those of you who don't know, it's came about in the early 1930s, invented by a young socialite. And that's a turkey sandwich, usually on white bread or on egg bread with strawberry jam and cream cheese. Oh, and like jam and cream cheese is sort of like peanut butter and jelly in Cuba. Children are practically raised on, you know, or they were on sandwiches of cream cheese and jelly. So adding a slice of turkey to it sounds unusual, but there's a lot of people who thought they would hate it and they end up liking it.
There's people who do cranberry and turkey sandwiches around Thanksgiving here.
Exactly.
Not my jam, so to speak. But yeah, that's not the most unusual thing I've ever heard. So what separates the Tampa Cuban from the Miami Cuban? How are they different and how are this huge controversy?
Is it just the salami or is there more to it than that?
Well, yeah, there's the bread. So, I mean, that's probably the most demonstrable thing. And you can easily see just visually if it's a Miami or a Tampa Cuban bread. So Tampa Cuban bread is craggy, you know, it's very uneven, you know, it's tends to be kind of crusty. Like on the outside, you'll often have the palmetto leaf running along the top.
Explain about that. Explain about that.
You know, a lot of people think it's for splitting the loaf, you know, which, you know, a lot of times like French bread, they'll just use a razor to kind of score the top so that the top of the loaf opens up and can release some of those gases. So you don't have these bubbles or bulges, et cetera. But really, John O. Miller just wrote a book on the palmetto. And so his whole thing is about, he thinks it has to do with regulation of temperature. Gary Mormino and I have been, batting this idea around for a long time, but I think it's probably the most probable reason why that they were added in the first place, because you'd have, you know, you might have 2 dozen loaves of bread in an oven, you know, and these are yard long loaves of bread, you know, so it's a big oven there and it's wood burning, you know, it's a wood burning oven. So you'd definitely have some hot spots and some cooler spots, et cetera. So your palmetto leaf would be a great kind of litmus test. If that palmetto leaf is starting to scorch, that means you need to move that loaf or rotate it or do something because you've got a hot spot over there. And I think that is probably the best reason.
We had Jono on the podcast recently. Folks can find that in the archive. So literally in the, I've never heard this. Right. In the oven, you would place the big fronds from a palmetto, and that was some sort of like temperature.
So for those of you who are familiar, if you go, there are still some places in Tampa like the La Segunda Bakery, and there's others that still use the palmetto leaf on top. So a lot of people, I don't know, they have all different kinds of reasons for thinking, but it's just become this tradition. Some people think it even adds flavor, which I really don't think so. The best we could tell is that the best reason why you would do that is, yes, as sort of a, like a thermometer, because if you've got a hot spot over there and you scorch 6 loaves of bread, that's 6 loaves of bread you're not selling anymore. You know, I mean,
so palmetto fronds were everywhere, and if they burned, who cares? And it was a canary in a coal mine.
Exactly, right. So you would just kind of embed that in the top of the loaf. Uh-huh. And it would sort of be there on the top. So it would give you a little indication before the bread started burning. So it's the very best that I've heard, you know, of a reason why that you would do it. It doesn't explain why we still do it, but now it's just
tradition. Yeah.
It's a signifier of it's sort of like taking out the brown M&Ms at the Van Halen concerts, you know, that story. But like, basically, it wasn't about the M&Ms. But if you looked and you saw no brown M&Ms, you knew that the rest of the tour rider, they paid attention to. What they really wanted was the right speakers, the right lights, et cetera. So.
Well, and La Segunda is pretty well known for their Cuban bread, so much so that some of the Miami places that sell their version of Cuban, they import the bread from La Segunda, right? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I want to emphasize too, there's not a right or a wrong way here. So like in Miami, it tended to be, it's a later kind of version of Cuban bread. And the easiest way to tell is it's smooth. The top of it is very smooth. It's like a baby's bottom, you know, there is no cragginess, wrinkles, not much variation. It's there, 'cause they're all cooked on a pan rather than directly in a hearth. Typically. And that's really what makes it different. Like La Segunda is different. And like the moment that you start, like that you take 2 dozen loaves and put it on a pan, you know, even if that pan is hot, it sucks all the heat out of it rather than having it on direct heat, which creates much more of like a shattering crust. And that's really what Tampa's Cuban bread is known for. It's just terribly messy. You know, some people actually in Miami have complained because, you know, it tears up their gums because it's so crusty, you know, such soft bread. So that's the main difference. And so I think that's one of the reasons why in Miami pressing really became mandatory, you know, because to give that bread some kind of toastiness, it must be pressed. Whereas like, you know, you can actually have a room temperature sandwich in Tampa, depending on the bread, and it can still be crusty and kind of crispy. I've had great room temperature sandwiches, non-pressed.
Okay.
And,
you know, well,
it depends on the bread.
That helps me a lot because I always assume Cuban sandwich is pressed. And then so that would be a Miami Cuban sandwich that is pressed.
Yeah. I mean, I still think
they press the ones in Tampa too, though.
Yes. But the electric press didn't become a thing until it became really popular in Miami. So you could have it heated up here in Tampa, but all right. So a few people used a tailor's iron to actually press.
Wow.
Or like a hot skillet, you know, put one skillet on top of another. And then like the Columbia, for example, actually had like a warming oven just for sandwiches because people had so many. So you would warm them in that oven, but the electric press really became like a sacrament of the Cuban in the late 50s and early 1960s. Before that, there you didn't see a lot of electric presses around Tampa.
What makes Cuban bread as opposed to wheat, rye, white, right. anything else?
Well, really, what we know is Cuban bread is known as water bread in Cuba, or pan de agua, which means that it's a bread that's made with no lard or no fat. So typically, you know, bread has a little fat in it. This has no fat in it. So that's one of the reasons why, like real Cuban bread, it's stale by the end of the day. Because it has nothing really to help it last, you know, as far as just being out in the air. So it goes stale typically by the end of the day. And that's why there's so many uses for like Cuban breadcrumbs. You know, devil crabs are mostly composed of Cuban breadcrumbs, stuffed potatoes, et cetera, et cetera. So you would just take that bread, you know, the next day and just grate it, use those breadcrumbs. Or you can make like a bread pudding or something like that.
Is there any basis to the story that the salami was added to salute the Italian immigrants who worked in Ybor City?
Right.
That's the story I've heard for years.
I know. And I kind of believed this erroneous assumption for a long time, too. Yeah, it's a great idea and a great, I don't know, poetic idea. Right. But I think, as we know, that's not how cooking really happens. Like let's have a block party and everyone will bring a slice of meat, you know. It just it sounds like a fable to me, you know. It's too pat. What I found is actually salami, it wasn't salami originally. It was Spanish style salami, salchichon. It's called salchichon. One of the reasons why I wanted to actually write this book on the Cuban sandwich is because there's so much hearsay out there, and everybody, you could talk to 1,000 people between here and Miami, who will tell you with passionate certainty, like, my grandfather invented it, or my grandfather was the one who put cheese on it for the first time, you know, or someone else will tell you, you know, the Cuban sandwich is just butter and ham, right? That's it, you know. So everybody's got this like passionate thing, but show me the money. Where's, you know, give me a source, give me something written besides this family hearsay or whatever. So that's why the book really relies on written sources for the most part. We have other parts of the book where we talk to people and interview people, but I didn't want to start getting into a he said, she said thing with all these people, you know, these 1,000 speakers between Tampa and Miami, whereas the written source here would tell the actual history, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And then as we get closer, of course, we can talk to people about things that have happened within our lifetimes. But the story about your great grandfather in 1908 or whatever, I just can't take that unless I have some kind of proof.
Right. Was it always considered sort of a working man's sandwich?
That's actually a really good question. And the one thing I'll just follow up on the salchichon, the salami.
Yeah.
The salchichon is very similar to salami. So it's like a hard salami. And then a lot of times you see, like in early accounts, they'll say it's a sandwich of, you know, sliced ham and chorizo. So they're often mentioning a chorizo, but it's a hard sausage. It's like a, you know, it's like a salchichon. That's the thing that's missing in a lot of this is the salami sort of component had been there all the time, pretty much. But it was often called sausage or something else. But working in the library and the archives at USF, I came across this salchichon thing. I was like, ooh, okay, that explains a lot, you know. And then going into your question then, Craig, about the working man sandwiches, no, it was not. So originally, I mean, these were all imported ingredients. People did not make Cuban bread at home. Cubans are much smarter than that. It's way too hot, you know, to bake bread at home. So virtually no Cubans baked bread. It was all commercially That's made nice. Bread, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so you would get all your stuff from bakeries, but then, you know, you've got to get ham, you've got to get cheese, all this other stuff. It's multiple ingredients. And the other thing that's kind of interesting quirk is that Cubans typically never ate sandwiches at home. Very few. I mean, you'd have the children's sandwiches I mentioned earlier of like cream cheese and jam. But typically, if you had a sandwich, you were out and about, and usually that was at night because it's so ungodly hot in Cuba that if you wanted to go out to have a good time, it was usually after dark. So the Cuban sandwich became something, something to eat between meals. But then also it was like a status thing, you know. So if you were going out on a carriage ride with your lady on a Friday night, you know, and you're all dressed up, you're in your carriage, it's like a Mercedes Benz at the time, you know, and everybody who was anybody taking a ride was seen with these little parcels in their hand. And it was this striped white paper with red stripes. And everybody had a sandwich wrapped up in these little things. And it was just one of those things to be seen with, you know, even if you weren't seen eating the sandwich, you had your parcel, you know. Mm-hmm. It was like you had the kit for the night, you know. And then for a lot of other people who couldn't afford their own carriages and their own riders and everything, you know, you're going out and that's your last stop of the night, right? Get a sandwich after you've been, you know, drinking rum and dancing all night or whatever.
Sounds good.
A lot of people, right? That became like the life-saving morsel at the end of the night. So much so
that like Waffle House today.
Right. Yeah. And so much so that they actually like adapted the sandwich to the medianoche. So you've got the medianoche version of the Cuban sandwich, which is served, it's typically a smaller sandwich. So rather than a construction guy, it's suitable for a lady after the theater to be able to eat by herself, right? It's also on a much more delicate and soft egg bread, kind of like a challah or something like that, but it's a medianoche bread that's made for, you know, much smaller, so you can actually eat that at 1 a.m. and not, you know, have indigestion at the end of the night. The other thing that's really interesting is how much ads there are for indigestion in Cuban periodicals, you know, and in one of them there's a doctor telling the guy, don't order the sandwich, you're going to be miserable, and but instead gives the guy some medicine so he can eat the whole thing and you know, live with himself afterwards.
Is there a particular tradition for the way it's cut? Because I mean, you almost always see it cut in that diagonal, so it's like it's got the sharp end to it.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, some people say, yeah, the sharper the angle, the more, the better it is. You know, it's supposed to be. How cool is that first bite? You know, it's like the tip of a spear. You know, and instead of having to wrap your mouth around the whole thing, you know, you can just, you know, bite off a little bit. You know, it's interesting because that's one of the other reasons why I think pressing became so popular, was just so you could fit the thing in your mouth. You know, for a lot of people, talking about, you know, this was a bigger sandwich than a lot of people were used to, especially like you think of, you know, the height of like, say, 1900. For the upper class, sandwiches were small, little dainty things with no crust on it, you know. And I go into a lot about that, about how, you know, sandwiches were always like a working man's thing. But it's one of the few dishes that has roots among the aristocrats, you know. I mean, as far as we know, the whole story about the Earl of Sandwich, I think it was the fourth Earl of Sandwich, is true, you know, except that he wasn't a gambler. He was a workaholic, you know. So he demanded sandwiches to keep his working papers ungreasy rather than his playing cards. But yeah, a political enemy made that whole thing up about the Earl being drunk all the time.
Yeah. Where's your favorite place to get a Cuban sandwich today?
Yeah, that's always a tricky question, but I think there's room for lots of people, but I'll give a couple. I think the Boozy Pig here in Tampa does a.
I love the name.
Yeah, it's a great job. And it's not an especially boozy place. It is BYOB. It's sort of based on the owner's name. The family name is Tambuzo. So in high school, he was always known as Boozy, but he's doing a great job. Andrew Tambuzo, it's kind of an upscale meat market, but their mixed dough sandwich is beyond reproach. The other one I would throw out there that's really kind of made a big impact in Miami in just the last couple of years is Sandwich Day Miami. And that's spelled Sandwich, Sandwich Day Miami.
I've been to that one. It's really good. Yeah.
Yes. So they, and they're doing their own bread, their own mustard, you know, everything but the cheese pretty much. So yeah, I think they do a great job. And, I mean, I've gone as far as gold bellying a couple of their, sandwiches during the lockdown, just so I, you know, could try it out. But I think those are two great places, as far as Tampa and Miami go. You know, there's lots of others. I mean, I think the Columbia has a nice sandwich too, but I try not to go too far. You know, I think one is enough. Because otherwise, then I run into getting a lot of hate mail.
Sort of along the lines of the farm to table and ingredients movement that has become so popular in cuisine in the last, I don't know, 10-20 years. At the beginning of the episode, you talked about this race to the bottom and processed ingredients, and everything is mechanically separated and this, that. Do you notice there are more restaurants bringing authentic Cuban sandwiches back to the menu in
absolutely
old school style?
Bless the younger generations. I mean, some people are really stepping up. I started to notice it 10 plus years ago, but really in the last 10-15 years. And I first started to see it in other places outside of Tampa and Miami. Yes, the whole thing of like this idea of kind of nose to tail butchery, and that's like the Boozy Pig is doing that. So like, for example, they'll use their trimmings from their beef to make the salami. So, for the sandwich. And yes, they do use salami. That's a great example. And like, I know when the Columbia kind of redid their sandwich a few years ago, discovered that they could save some money, because they were using, a certain cut and it was already made and everything. And by making their own, they actually make a better product while actually saving a little bit of money. Everyone thought it was going to be more expensive. So it all depends, but they, of course, they have a lot of volume on their side, whereas a lot of other sandwich slingers wouldn't. But when I talk about the race at the bottom too, it's more complex than just a story of kind of the Americanization of the sandwich. A lot of it has to do with the exile and with the story of, Cuban immigration and exile. So what you had in the late 50s and early 60s is a lot of people being forced out of Cuba again in numbers that were unprecedented before. You know, the exile experience for Cuba began in the 1820s, 1840s. We've had in the U.S. an exile community ever since then. But those were smaller numbers compared to, millions of people starting in, say, 1959, roughly, with Castro and everything. So what happens is you have a lot of people who are becoming sandwich people for the first time, becoming loncheros. A lonchero is the day before we had, mechanical slicers. So a lonchero is someone who was an expertly, would cut the sandwiches up and prepare them and everything. And what happens is a lot of these immigrants did not want to charge, a lot of money for the sandwich for their fellow Cubans, So there was one example where it took the guy almost 10 years to add cheese to the sandwich because he didn't want to raise the price by 20 cents or whatever it was at the time. Wow. So, that is another consideration and maybe one of the reasons why the sandwich didn't get quite so blinged out in Miami, right? They didn't, it got reduced down to the ham, and the pork, which is really the essential, ingredients. And then like, if you had other combinations, so like the Latin American cafeteria, for example, they had like 30 different Cuban sandwiches on their menu, but their only one of them was the Cuban sandwich. you'd have the Cuban sandwich deluxe, the Cuban sandwich this with the other stuff added onto it, but it wouldn't be called a Cuban sandwich. It would be something else. So like, for example, like you can get a Cuban sandwich with croquettes, ham croquettes mashed in there, and they call that a croqueta preparada, basically. But it's not called the Cuban sandwich with a croquette, It's a semantical thing, but it's also, I think it's important, because that is, to me that's the flag of exile, I mean, they fly the Cuban flag, in Miami, but it's so interesting because it became a political thing too. I mean, I think quietly, but not so quietly in Miami, but it became so
nothing's quiet in Miami.
Yeah. And so ingrained in the identity of Miami that I think that's one of the reasons why the state of Cuba, which runs all the restaurants for the most part there now, except for your Paladares, different story. But in terms of where most tourists are going to and having a mass experience, it wasn't until very, very, very recently that you could find anything resembling a Cuban sandwich in Cuba. And they wouldn't call it a Cuban sandwich. It would be a ham sandwich, a terrible, ham sandwich. But now they're actually like, the Sloppy Joe's bar has brought back something they call a Sloppy Joe, and it's this huge mound of meat and olives and everything. So they're starting to bring back these things, but I think for a long time it was like the exile community had claimed these things, you know, before. Mm-hmm. So the idea of like the Cuban state saying, oh, we have Cuban sandwiches is like kind of embarrassing, you know, especially because what they're going to serve in Cuba is going to be so much worse than what you get in Miami, you know?
Yeah. It's gonna be like a Publix Cuban sandwich,
right? If I mean, if that, quality. Would be the best you could expect in Cuba. So it's interesting because you know politics has kind of affected it too. And for the longest time, it didn't seem like you were ever gonna find a Cuban sandwich in Cuba again. But now it's slowly starting to change, and I think they want to reclaim that for the island itself and as a way to separate more Yankees from their hard currency.
Now I have to ask you this. I just heard this from a Florida folk singer named Bill Suggs, who said that he had heard somewhere that the Dagwood sandwich from the comic strips originated from the guy who drew the comic strip being stationed in Tampa during World War II and seeing Cuban sandwiches. Did that really happen?
I haven't heard any of that, but I would love to know if he has a citation. Yeah, I would love to know
about that.
I have heard people talk about the Cuban sandwich and say, yeah, it's kind of like a Dagwood, but I've never heard the story of the two actually being connected.
Yeah.
Right. but I mean, I could see that.
Andrew Hughes has been our guest. From Salons to Steakhouses, A History of Tampa, the first book coming up hopefully in 2022, The Cuban Sandwich, A History in Layers. It's time to go eat, Andy.
And that would be Saloons to Steakhouses, not Salons. Don't do that.
Saloons.
To me,
I apologize for that. Saloons. Big difference. Yeah.
Yeah. No kidding.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. This is a lot of fun.
Thanks. I learned a lot. And got hungry.
You have a favorite sandwich, Craig?
I love a good Cuban. I don't get to eat the authentic kind the way I used to. There used to be this place near the St. Pete Clearwater Airport called the Airport Variety Store. Just this little hole in the wall place. But it was near the criminal courts complex when I was covering criminal courts, you know, I'd go over there 2-3 times a week and order a Cuban. And it would, you know, everybody in there is very surly. They would barely talk to you. You know, you'd say, yeah, one Cuban, and they're like, and then the guy would go, you know, put it all together, do it in the press, give it to you. And you take it outside. You'd sit on it. They had two picnic tables sitting outside, usually occupied by most of the bailiffs from the courthouse.
Yeah.
And oh my God, it was so good. It would just be like, you would be ecstatic and it'd be like, okay, now I can go back and face, you know, the rest of this murder trial or whatever I'm covering. Yeah, you know,
listening to Andy, I don't know that I've had, well, I'm sure that I haven't had an authentic Cuban sandwich. So I've written down and I'll put in the show notes the two establishments that he mentioned, one in Tampa, one in Miami, for folks who are traveling through who live there. They can check those out and get an authentic a Cuban sandwich, and that would certainly be worth the price of admission at either of those places.
Oh, absolutely.
Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida. Bring your appetite.